right. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next matter on our oral argument calendar this morning is A230464 in the matter of the short call substitute teaching license application of Geronimo Yanez. Just a couple housekeeping matters before we start. You can adjust the height of the podium. There's a switch in the front that will move it up and down. There is a recording being made of the proceeding today. It will be available on the court's website afterwards. That's the only official recording of the proceeding. There's no other recording that should be made in the courtroom. It's also being live streamed on Zoom. When you start, could you please announce your name and how you'd like us to refer to you? Appellant or the relator will have 15 minutes for the initial argument, 5 minutes for rebuttal, and respondent will have 15 minutes. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Fowler.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Fowler. Mr. Fowler is fine. We are here today on a second appeal. This case was already appealed once and remanded back to the board for a decision on the short call substitute teacher's license of my client, Geronimo Yanez. I submit to you that there are two main issues to consider on this second appeal. First is whether or not, to simply put it, the board did what this court said it should do. And I submit to you it did not. There are three sort of subcategories within that. And then the second part, if we need to reach that issue, is whether or not the board's decision is supported by substantial evidence. And I've submitted to you that it is not. Now, in the case below, we never got to the merits of whether or not this was supported by substantial evidence because the issue was there needed to be a narrowing instruction so that this statute would be constitutional. However, I think what's really important is that this court did more than say, here is a new standard, please go apply it. Given some of the dubious inferences, as this court noted in its footnotes of the opinion, it said you need to look at this evidence with great circumspection and reconsider this evidence in light of our decision. And I submit to you the board did not do that at all.
I appreciate that that's the focus of your argument. But I look at the two board decisions, the one that was presented to this court on the first appeal and the one that is before us today, and see they are very different. I mean, the first time around, the board adopted and mostly all of the administrative law judge's findings of fact and made a few legal conclusions, whereas on remand from this court, the board made explicit adoption of ALJ findings, made its own new findings, and entered into an extensive discussion of how your client's conduct and morals would affect the professional morals related to the teaching profession. What more should the board have done to comply with the requirement or the direction of this court to use great circumspection?
So, number one, the board did not reopen the record, so there was no new evidence or testimony taken. So,
and this court hadn't told the board that it needed to do that.
No, you're correct, Your Honor. The court said you may if you wish. I'm just simply stating that there is not new evidence in the record. And so then what happened was, with all due respect, Your Honor, I think what the board did is simply relabeled the exact same police misconduct and said now it magically relates to the profession of teaching by a code of conduct for discipline. Now, keep in mind, my client is not yet a teacher, so I wonder if that applies, and said this now relates. And I think one of the most pointed pieces of evidence that shows they didn't take this job seriously is the question of the chair, Dr., I'm going to say this name wrong, Osuji, who says, Mr. Fowler, isn't a police officer supposed to be a peace officer? And then the chair goes on to say, well, shouldn't that relate to peacekeeping in a classroom? And I went on to explain how vastly different the profession of law enforcement and the profession of teaching are, and that they're in no way analogous. A person may be called a peace officer, but their job is anything but peaceful because of their daily work.
So is it your position that the board should not have considered any conduct of your client as a police officer in deciding whether to issue the license to your client?
Well, Your Honor, I think if they're simply relabeling it and saying, oh, we give this great weight, that's not really re-examining the evidence. They're saying, this is the exact same conduct. We're going to do a result-oriented analysis and still deny the license, and we'll just craft a decision that says it relates to it and gives it, quote, great weight. I mean, it really wasn't a detailed breakdown of, well, here's why we give this particular factor so much weight. It just was a broad statement. We give it great weight.
But you agree as a baseline that your client's conduct as a peace officer is fair game for consideration, just like if he had any other job and there was some sort of conduct that came to the board's attention in deciding whether to issue a license, he isn't accepted from consideration of that conduct simply because he worked as a peace officer. Do you agree?
I would agree if that relates to the profession of teaching. And what I'm submitting to this court is that it is such a different profession. We are talking about an officer-involved shooting that involves less than perfect information made in a split-second basis. That's really the crux of the tragedy that happened. And to say that that relates to the occupation of teaching, backing up a step.
Let me ask, can I ask you this first of all?
Sure.
Rule 8710.2100 that establishes the Code of Ethics for Minnesota Teachers, do you agree that that's relevant to the professional morals that relate to the teaching profession?
I do, if it's applicable as applied to discipline, for sure, because that's the standard that would be used. Similar to attorney discipline, if there's a standard, it applies to attorneys. The question I would have is, this court cautioned that the substitution of one nebulous standard for another is not going to be sufficient. And I think that when you're making the giant stretch that conduct that is purely law enforcement related somehow relates to the profession of teaching, I honestly question if this court was able to simply relabel the same conduct and say that it relates to teaching, why was the case remanded? I mean, this court could just simply say, well, it relates enough and we uphold it. But I think the court asked the board to do more. And I think any reasonable attorney reading this would say, you need to re-examine the evidence. That's what you told them to do.
I want to clarify something. You referred to 8710.2100 as relating to discipline. It's the code of ethics for Minnesota teachers, right? It implies in all situations whether or not a teacher is subject to discipline or not.
Well, Your Honor, it does apply to teachers, and my client is applying for a teacher's position. So one would need to know what conduct is prescribed and not prescribed before applying to be a teacher. I mean, that code is relevant for if you have a fact scenario where, you know, maybe we're not going to renew your license or there is discipline. But, I mean, it's the same thing with attorney standards. If you're not an attorney, it doesn't apply to you.
To play out your analogy, certainly the bar looks at your personal conduct before you become a lawyer and decides whether or not you would pass the moral character evaluation to become an attorney. And that's things that you did when you weren't a lawyer, right? Agree that that's relevant.
It is relevant, but I would say that in light of this court's decision, it must relate to the professional occupation of lawyering. So, again, what we have here is purely law enforcement conduct. And this board is now saying, we're going to say that it's related to teaching. Taking a step back, because I do want to take a step back and look at the big picture here. This event is 7 years old. This is not the national media storm that everybody's making it out to be. People in Duluth have never heard of my client. This is a statewide board. Now, do we have the burden of establishing that he's fit to teach? I would submit to you that the best evidence on this record is the fact that he's been teaching now for 3 years and has, by all accounts in the record, favorable reviews, great praise from his principal. He's in a school, admittedly private, that has 30% people of color, roughly 25-30%, and not one of them has been traumatized.
The board considered all that, made extensive findings reflecting in fact that your client has been able to be successful in a teaching setting. But are we in a position to reweigh that decision, that evidence is outweighed by what his conduct as peace officer demonstrated about his ability to comply with the code of ethics for teachers?
Well, two things, Your Honor. I would disagree. My reading of the record indicates that the board did not flesh out any data, evidence, studies, publication that supports their finding that people of color will automatically be traumatized. I think that's a little pandering to suggest that our Minnesota kids are going to be automatically traumatized by an event 7 years ago that is far out of the public consciousness. In fact, the evidence shows, I don't believe they said why a public school kid is going to be different than a private school kid. We have the evidence on the record that none of those students of colors have any issue. There's been no problems. That's evidence.
I thought the key difference was the choice. One of the key facts identified by the board's finding is that people that attend a private school that may know that your client teaches there are making a choice to put their child there to issue a license to your client that's a statewide license where that person may be a substitute teacher called into a certain school is what the board's concern was, that, you know, the parents at that school that day where your client's substituting, they don't have that choice.
Well, I would submit to you, Your Honor, that the school hired Mr. Yanez at some point, and there was students there that didn't have a choice to have him because they were already there. So again, those 30% weren't impacted. And I think that's really important, that I believe that fear is not evidence. Fear of what might happen without publication, without study, without some basis in evidence, because that's what we're all here for is in the law, is to make sense out of things on the record with evidence and prove facts. Dr. Gothard's statement that, oh, I believe all the kids are going to be traumatized and it matters because, you know, they don't have a choice, flesh that out for me. You know, I don't understand the doctor being able to say that and the board to give it that kind of weight with no evidentiary support, no academic study, no publication, no case studies, no nothing. Fear is not evidence. If we're going to make law based on what could happen, I think we are in trouble.
Wasn't he qualified as an expert and his expert report stipulated to you for admission before the board?
I actually do want to address that point. I reviewed the itemized contents of the record, and I remember very specifically directing my associate to object to the expert testimony. Itemized record number 17 was a motion to exclude. It was rejected by the LJ, so there was no stipulation to his expert. We objected to that, because I know Mr. Cullen brought that up in his brief that, well, you didn't object. Yes, we did. We filed the whole motion on it. And again, I believe that, as I address later in my brief, in the second part, I believe the expert testimony of Dr. Gothard should be given little, if any, weight, because he's not an expert on police issues. He's an expert on education. But to say I'm going to take the profession of policing and say that I'm now an expert enough to form an opinion over here, that was the basis for our motion. Also, I would submit to you that as the superintendent of the district where Mr. Castile worked, and he refers to him as my beloved, can you imagine being a witness in a case and you've got your expert witness referring to the deceased as such? I mean, you would think that that's a little bit biased, I would think.
Well, although he wasn't there at the time that Mr. Castile worked for the district, correct?
No, but from what his testimony was, he clearly believed that he was beloved and he was a person of great importance.
I'd like to ask you a different question, and that is, do you quarrel with the board's reliance on the Morrison case and particularly the 8 factors that the Morrison court identified in terms of evaluating whether someone's conduct or how someone's character or conduct relates to professional morals of teaching?
Your Honor, I don't qualify that Morrison is good law, but I do, as I raised in my argument to the board itself, and I believe it's in the third page, 30-something around that time frame, I expressed to the board that this court was aware of the Morrison factors on the first time, and if it was simply a matter of being able to relabel and apply police conduct to teaching conduct, this court would have done that. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that the court would have done that. But instead,
first instance, we would have made those kinds of findings.
Well, I think
isn't that what the board did on remand, was make findings related to the Morrison factors based on the record?
I don't think the board did that, in all fairness. I think what the board did is they engaged in a result-oriented approach, and they said, we're going to relabel this same police conduct as relating somehow to the morals of teaching, citing some codes.
Or did the board contextualize, as we directed on remand, that the evidence didn't change, but contextualize that evidence into what a teacher's role would be and how the character and conduct relates to teaching?
Well, writing it on a piece of paper doesn't make it so. And I think that's what they did is, you know, the Attorney General's office said, here's a proposed opinion, please adopt it. And I don't really think, based on the questioning from the board, which I was present at, there was no re-examining of that evidence. They simply had a result in mind and plowed forward with it. And I think the findings that are made are not supported by substantial evidence. It begs the question, why is the most clear-cut evidence, which is my client's been teaching, doing great for 3 years with no problems, why is that being ignored? At every reference on this record, anything favorable to my client is ignored. And I think the board continued that pattern when they had their second hearing. They're trying to draw the inference that, you know, if you're a police officer, you need to be peaceful in a classroom and all that. It's a completely different profession. I see that I'm out of time. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is David Cullen. I'm an assistant attorney general representing the Minnesota Professional Licensing and Standards Board. The board properly reconsidered the record in this matter, correctly applied the court's narrowing construction of the term immoral character or conduct, and issued an order with detailed findings and conclusions supporting its denial of Mr. Yanez' application. The board respectfully requests that the court affirm its order. I'd like to touch on three main points in support of affirming the board's order. First, the board properly applied the court's narrowing construction by considering Mr. Yanez's conduct in relation to the Code of Ethics for Minnesota teachers and concluded that his conduct was contrary to the professional morals of teaching. Second, the board correctly applied the court's narrowing construction by considering the Morrison factors and concluded that his conduct renders him unfit to serve as a licensed substitute teacher in Minnesota public schools. Third and finally, the board did base its decision on substantial evidence.
Can I ask you this? What is there a particular part of the board's on remand findings, conclusions of law, and memorandum that would convince us that the board in fact used great circumspection and rather than simply relabeling its prior decision?
Thank you, Your Honor. The order in its entirety and the memorandum supporting the order demonstrates the great circumspection that the board used in deciding this matter. There was a robust hearing with questions and answers between the parties and deliberations afterwards in closed session with the board. So I think the order itself is the best indicator of the great circumspection that the board used in deciding this case.
What's your response to your counterpart's argument that the board erred by failing to credit the favorable evidence regarding Mr. Yanez's performance as a parochial school teacher? Why isn't it error that the board didn't consider that a better measure in support of issuing a license?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good question. The board's order clearly considered the testimony of the principal at the private school where Mr. Yanez taught, acknowledged that Mr. Yanez received favorable reviews from that principal, and as the court noted in its discussion with my counterpart, drew out the distinction between teaching in a small private school where families choose to send their students and children as opposed to teaching under a statewide license as a substitute teacher in Minnesota public schools, where families don't necessarily have that same choice as to where they'll send their school children.
Would this have differed any if the position he was being considered for was a regular classroom teacher where he wouldn't be going from class to class and school to school?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I frankly don't know the answer to that because that wasn't before the board, but I think the board would have looked at the same narrowing construction that this court provided as guidance. It would have looked at the conduct in relation to the professional morals of teaching under the Code of Ethics for Minnesota teachers. It would have considered the Morrison factors as to the impact on that conduct and whether or not that conduct rendered Ms. Gianna's unfit to serve as a classroom teacher. My personal opinion is that the outcome would have been the same.
Do you want to respond to the counsel's argument that there was an objection to the expert report and assuming that that was properly before us, why we should still, why it was an error for the board to consider that opinion?
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. There was a motion in limine to narrow the scope of Dr. Gothard's testimony. That motion was denied by the administrative law judge. It is true that Mr. Yanez's counsel, Mr. Fowler's colleague, did stipulate to the admissibility of the expert report.
After the denial of the motion in limine, is that what happened?
Prior to the denial of the motion in limine. And this issue that Mr. Young has brought up in his briefing through Mr. Fowler about the admissibility and credibility of Dr. Gothard's opinions and testimony, frankly, was a little difficult to follow. As the court knows, those decisions of credibility and admissibility are left to the discretion of the trial court. Or in this case, the board. Dr. Gothard absolutely was qualified, tendered, and accepted as an expert in the field of education, and there was more than sufficient foundation for all of his opinions offered both in the expert report and in his testimony at the hearing.
Of what significance are the comments that Relator's counsel referenced of the board chair during the hearing about peace officers and being peaceful? And
I think, if anything, those comments underscore the circumspection that the board undertook in exploring the issues and asking questions and giving Mr. Fowler an opportunity to state his case on behalf of his client. The board clearly considered the conduct at issue in connection with the Code of Ethics in terms of teachers being required to deliver educational services in a non-discriminatory manner, the requirement that teachers use reasonable disciplinary authority to maintain an atmosphere conducive to learning, and the requirement that teachers protect students from conditions harmful to health and safety. So, Your Honor, I think that that shows the great circumspection and the careful consideration the board engaged in here. And with respect to the narrowing construction, the board absolutely followed and appreciated the guidance from this court in directing it to consider both how the conduct at issue pertains to the professional morals of teaching, which it did through the Code of Ethics. And this court identified Morrison as a seminal case in a line of cases about teacher discipline or teacher licensing statutes involving prohibitions against immoral character or conduct. In fact,
But Morrison involved someone who was already a teacher and conduct that occurred maybe not in the classroom but much more closely related to teaching because it involved another school employee, as I recall.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in our brief, we also cited other case from the California Supreme Court, I believe, that involved application of the Morrison factors to a candidate for licensure as opposed to a licensed teacher. So I think Morrison is just as applicable under these circumstances. And frankly, I think the court thought it was applicable under these circumstances in directing the board to consider the impact of how Mr. Yanez's conduct renders him unfit to serve as a licensed substitute teacher in Minnesota public schools. And the board considered all eight of the Morrison factors and did assign weight to each of those eight factors. The three most heavily weighted factors that the board considered under Morrison were the likely adverse impact of the conduct at issue on students and teachers at the time. The likely adverse impact, if Mr. Yanez were to become licensed as a substitute teacher and serve as such in Minnesota public schools, and the aggravating factors of the conduct at issue. So it was a very careful and deliberate analysis of Morrison.
But was the Morrison analysis really determinative in this case? I mean, the board didn't cite Morrison in its reasons for decision. It really seemed to, in conclusions of law, it seemed to frame that analysis in terms of the code of ethics for teachers. And I don't think in our previous decision we pointed the board to the code of ethics for teachers, and your counterpart here takes some exception to applying the code of ethics for teachers, although he categorized it as a disciplinary code, but applying it to Mr. Yanez. Can you explain why it was appropriate for the board to use the code of ethics for Minnesota teachers as its benchmark in determining whether there was immoral character or conduct here?
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, on the first point about Morrison, Morrison is explicitly referenced in the board's memorandum in support of its order.
And I understand that, but I'm referring to the conclusions of law.
Understood. And in paragraph 15 of the conclusions of law, all eight of the Morrison factors are set forth in the board's order. And I'm sorry, I think I lost the question as to the code of ethics for Minnesota teachers, Your Honor.
Yeah, as I understood it, that was more the central thrust of the board's conclusions of law, why the code of ethics for Minnesota teachers is the appropriate benchmark to determine whether or not there was a more immoral conduct.
I think that's a fair statement. As the board applied the narrowing construction from this court, it was a two-step process. And step one was to identify whether or how the conduct at issue pertains to the professional morals of teaching. And the code of ethics for Minnesota teachers, not unlike the character fitness aspect of lawyering, for example, that Your Honor brought up, was the obvious choice to the board. I think the court showed some deference, and appropriately so, to the board in the prior opinion, in not saying, here's what that set of ethics ought to be. You tell us, you're the board appointed with the experience, education, background, and expertise in this field. And of course, the board went to the code of ethics. I think that the court certainly signaled to the board that the Morrison factors were applicable, important, called Morrison a seminal case in this line of cases. And appropriately, the board followed the court's guidance in that regard. As far as the substantial evidence, there was substantial evidence here. The findings were detailed. We talked about the testimony of the principal. That was acknowledged and discussed by the board. There were findings that the principal was not an expert in licensing, nor was he tendered as an expert in licensing, and that the board made the distinction between teaching in a private school and a public school. The credibility and admissibility determinations, we talked about that, and the great deference that the appellate courts show to trial courts or boards on making such determinations. And with respect to the racial profiling issue, that is supported by substantial evidence. By definition, under the statute, 626.8471 subdivision 2, racial profiling is defined as any action by law enforcement that relies on the race of an individual rather than the behavior or information that leads to a particular individual identified as having been engaged in criminal activity. Racial profiling, the definition goes on to state, includes the use of racial stereotypes in deciding whom to stop. And the record supports that that's what happened here. And so there's substantial evidence for that. And then that feeds into the code of ethics, the requirement that teachers deliver educational services in a non-discriminatory manner. And it feeds into Morrison, the aggravating factors and the adverse impact of this conduct. As far as the aggravating factors go, the board talked about the notoriety and the violent and harrowing nature of the killing at issue here, as illustrated by the videos that have been viewed millions of times throughout the world, talked about the extreme and disproportionate response that occurred during this stop, and talked about the trauma and the re-traumatization that all students could be exposed to by his mere presence in the classroom. And Dr. Gothard himself testified that he couldn't imagine creating an adequate safety plan to address the concerns of Ms. Giannis being in a classroom as a licensed substitute teacher in our public schools. In closing, unless the court has additional questions, the board properly reconsidered the record, correctly applied the court's narrowing construction of the term immoral character or conduct, and issued an order with detailed findings and conclusions supporting its denial of the application. The board respectfully requests that the court affirm its order. Thank you.
May it please the court again. In rebuttal, Your Honors, I want to start a little backwards with the racial profiling issue. Mr. Giannis has taken great issue with this finding from the very beginning of this case and throughout. So the same statute that has just been quoted talks about, but not from information from a particular case. My client viewed the robbery video and formed a mental impression of the appearance of this person. And he testified about that in other places in the record. But just like this issue of the weight of the teaching and that he's actually doing it, it gets discounted. Instead, this board is focused on one radio transmission that he's recounting later, keeping in mind that my client's first language is in English. He says, and that one piece is repeatedly referred to by the board, but they don't look at all the other evidence where he says more clearly and in more detail, this is why I stopped Mr. Castile. And it's instances like that that are replete throughout this record that should lead anybody to believe that there is not a fair crediting of positive and negative evidence going on in this case. This is a perfect example. What is an officer to do when they see an African-American person on a video? Is that automatically going to be treated as racial profiling? The way the board would have it, it sounds like it. But my client was the one who investigated this crime. So we take great issue with this as being just, I pulled over a black man. That is not the case in this case. And if we're going to label my client a racist and racial profiling, there ought to be substantial evidence. And all the evidence should be considered, not just the cherry-picked parts that paint my client a bad light. And going back to the issue about, so it seems like the distinction is choice. So public school kids don't have a choice and private school kids do. I don't think that's the issue. The issue is, what evidence do we have of potential racial trauma by the mere presence of my client 7 years after the fact? There is no evidence on this record. It is pure conjecture, pure speculation, pure fear-mongering. There's just not any evidence to suggest that in the record.
What about your client's reaction? It's described in the decision to viewing the video during his testimony and the comments that were made that if a student played the video in the classroom, and your client clearly, according to the board, had a traumatic response to having to see the video again. What if a student played that in the classroom? What if someone taunted him? How would he respond in that situation? It seemed like the board considered those types of issues with regard to the incident, and specifically how your client would do in a public school classroom.
Well, as I indicated immediately upon that argument being made on the record below, I think that it was appalling that my client's humanity and understanding that this was a tragedy is being used against him. All I can say is that for 3 years, everybody in that school knows who my client is. Nobody has taunted him. Nobody's done these things. We are worried about things that have never happened and have no evidence to suggest they will ever happen. And that's the problem I have with Dr. Gothard's testimony. He's saying, I'm afraid of this, but he's got no evidence to support it other than his experience. And I think Dr. Gothard, with all due respect, is biased. And I think that there just isn't a case or a study or an article or anything that we would call evidence to suggest that this will happen. This is pure fear. And I just, We have a situation where my client is trying to move on in his life. And after 7 years, this matter has died down. And I think that if we're going to forever deny licenses based on this conduct, so far different than the profession at hand, where would it end? Could my client not get a barber's license? Could my client not get a law license? I think the reason we're appealing this case is, sure, he's got a job now in the private schools, but what if that school closes? What if he wants to move on? This will forever be a bar. This will always be used by the district, by the board to bar him. And, you know, I deal in labor employment law for most of my career. And, you know, arbitrators, when even looking at discipline, they apply the doctrine of staleness. And this is now stale. By the time this court makes a decision, it'll be 7 years or more removed from the actual incident. We've had subsequent intervening events, like the case involving Derek Chauvin. This is not the foremost thing on students' minds. I think we are giving very little credit to students of color to automatically assume that they will be traumatized. That's a little bit of a racial stereotype there to say that that will happen when there's been no evidence on the record that it will. Again, in closing, it's been 7 years. My client just wants an opportunity to move on. And by all evidence that is favorable to my client, he has certainly done a good job. And I think that if this is an educational setting, perhaps people could learn from this and maybe reach some consensus on these issues of policing, which have become so politicized. And so there's an opportunity here. And I don't think there's any evidence to suggest my client is of a bad moral character. As you mentioned, you know, viewing a video and understanding, most police officers don't want to wake up and have an officer-involved shooting. That's not what they're in the business for. So the humanity that he demonstrates, I don't believe, is a negative. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. The matter is deemed submitted. We will issue a decision in the statutory 90-day time frame.